Assignment 6, a public interest series of this station, presents San Juan Heritage, a realistic look at the history of the great San Juan Basin and its people. Your hosts for this series are Dr. Robert Delaney, head of the Center for Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College, and Mr. Arthur Wyatt, former state representative and longtime resident of the basin. Their guest for tonight's program is Mr. Abe Zuni, superintendent of the Consolidated Ute Agency. This is the third program in the series entitled The American Indian, First Inhabitant of the San Juan Basin. Tonight's topic is the modern Indian. Let's join our hosts.
Into this big San Juan Basin that was vacated by the cliff dwellers that we were talking about last time, there moved in the modern Indians, particularly of two language groups, the Uto-Aztecan and the Athapascan, thus accounting for the Utes in this area, the Southern Utes and the Ute Mountain Utes, and the Apache groups close by, the Jicarí Apaches at Dulce, and the Navajos, of course, down to the south and a little bit to the west of us. At first, they came in small bands, wandered on foot, gathering food, but as this was about the time, or a little bit before the discovery of America, and of course it wasn't too long after that the Spanish moved up into New Mexico, and as horses escaped from the Spanish and multiplied, it changed the culture complex, or it changed the habits of living of the modern Indians, from walking on foot and carrying everything to horse riders, teepee dwellers, buffalo hunters, and all of that. But we right here in the San Juan Basin are in one of the richest areas in the whole United States for both the modern Indian and for the old, as we have talked about on previous programs. But Arthur, you've lived in this area a long time, how long I won't say, but I know that you have seen a lot of progress or changes in living among the modern Indians. What have you observed?
Well, I have noticed, Bob, that here when I first came down into this country, the Indians, of course, had started using the horses that the Spaniards had brought in. They had adapted themselves to the Hogan, and you know, from that time up till now, there has been quite a decided improvement, I think, in the way they have lived in the areas around us here. They've graduated from the horse to the horse and wagon, the horse and wagon to the pickup, the car, the truck, and a lot of them are flying now, too. The housing situation has improved. Many of those who have gone to school and have come back to the reservation are now living in houses served by electricity, and they have the electrical appliances. Some areas where they have gas available, they have gas heat. They are accustomed to using the radio, and a lot of areas the TV. So there's been quite a decided change along that line. Then I think the most important one, and it is the one that affects their health, the modern improvement in food. You know, it hasn't been too long back when the Indian, being migratory, following the herds of wildlife for their food. Of course, among the Pueblos, they did some crop growing, naturally, and hunted and preserved their meats and the like. But with the coming of the reservation, many of them have learned to farm. They're growing many crops. They're using modern equipment, and their food has improved, and the death rate has decreased, and the tribes are now increasing, where for many years they were on a decreasing basis. Then I'll tell you another thing that helped, of course, along that line was modern medicine. And it took some time for them to adapt themselves to modern medicine. But now we're building hospitals on the reservation to take care of their medical needs, dental clinics for tooth care, and they're even using, of course, the general hospitals off the reservation.
Yes, very definitely.
The child loss has declined, and they have improved remarkably in their living on the reservation here for quite some little time now. But to me, this last 35 years has been the great change. We've made, as some people call it, the great leap forward, and they've kept up better than most people had anticipated that they could. I think they have gained more, faster than even some of the Anglo tribe people in the country. And we have had another change that I think Mr. Zuni could tell us more about, and that's the change from the chief type of government to the elected commission or council form of government. What about that, Mr. Zuni?
Well, first of all, to review history in its proper perspective, when the Indians were forced into smaller territories as a result of the western migration of the Americans, they had to reconstitute their government in order to cope with a changing environment. The old system of the chief, the chieftains, and in some cases where the religious leaders were the political leaders as well. This is true of the Pueblos, where they had a theocracy.
Yes,
actually,
that's right.
Compared to the Utes in this area, they had chiefs based upon proven bravery in battles, and also selected for their wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to come to the modern times, the legislation that was passed by Congress in 1934 permitted the tribes, for the first time, to organize a formal government that was recognized by the United States government as well as the states in the Union. This permitted the tribes, for the first time, to play politics in the modern sense of the word.
Yeah, that's right.
And my observation has been that they're as shrewd and as sharp as anyone that I've come across today.
They even kiss babies, eh?
Oh, yes. Nothing is left undone in order to get into office. Now, there are some groups that pay salaries to their elected officials. Some do not. And I believe this is true democracy, where individuals are willing to serve the people without any pay. About the only reward that they get is, like some of our politicians today, dishonor, disgrace, a lot of complaints directed against them. But nevertheless, they're willing to go ahead and do the best they can for their constituents.
Well, do you think that that has been an improvement? Has it helped the tribes to progress, those that have adopted the council form of government?
Yes, after the adoption of the constitutions, they were able to have a more stable form of government than formerly. With the election of officials for a designated period of time, they were able to stabilize their government, and as a result, you had continuity, which has now been interrupted, except by annual elections.
They were able to plan better, is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yes, this gave them a better organization for planning, for developing programs, for carrying on necessary governmental reforms, actually. And this also gave them an opportunity to come to grips with the economic problems that they were faced with.
Well, you know, some of the tribes, and particularly in this area, have received considerable money from the federal government in settlement for some of the lands that were taken away from them and the like. Was it an improvement in the use of the money to have the council form of government over coming to each individual in the tribe and just being handed out to them? What's been the experience along that line?
Well, of course, the Indians are no different from the average American. Everybody wants to have money. Everybody wants to individualize community funds. And this was one of the first big problems faced by the tribes that have come into considerable wealth. However, I believe that by the use of a tribal government, where the government is able to plan
some of the programs that cannot be done on an individual basis. I think in this particular area a lot of progress has been made. However, I don't believe that the government should be all-encompassing and do all the programming for the individual Indian.
Oh, goodness no. I think everybody would deplore that.
Well, they never will learn if they did. If they aren't given the opportunity to handle it themselves, will they?
To have some initiative.
That's right.
I'd like to ask both of you gentlemen something about culture changes. This is something that fascinates me, is the culture of the Indian, the North American Indian in general, and specifically the Indians around here. But I would like for one or both of you to comment on what cultural changes you think you have seen, say, in the last 15 or 20 years.
Well, I've seen them come from the little schools that they established, boarding schools they established in various places over the reservation, and they, particularly down on the Navajo reservation. And they were very small, and there weren't many of them going to school. Then the larger boarding schools were established, and more interest was taken in education. I think with the boys coming back from the service that had served with the troops abroad and the like and got a kind of a world picture of the cultures and education and the like.
Like Abe Jenny and his B-24s here.
Made quite a contribution to the progress of education. And I was going to ask you, Mr. Zuni, what you thought of the present situation of education. And before you answer it, I want to mention that we have been bombarded with information on integration and the like. And I believe over at Ignacio you have integrated schools, don't you?
Yes, we do. The Southern Ute children have been attending the Ignacio Public School for the last 6 or 7 years. And everyone there is very happy with the results.
That's what I've heard.
And getting back to your comments of great cultural changes, I'd like to make an observation within my lifetime. I think the greatest impact on the Indians was the war, Second World War. For some known reason and unknown reasons, this started a new era as far as the Indians are concerned. For one thing, this opened, especially in the Southwest, some economic opportunities that were heretofore unknown and unavailable to the Indian people. And then, of course, with the boys in the service, they had a chance to leave the reservation, leave the states, and see the world. And naturally, when they came back, they brought back a lot of alien ideas into the reservation, some that were not welcome, of course, but nevertheless, they were able to make an impact. And the economic changes on the reservations themselves caused the people to take another look regarding their own culture, and as well as the greater American culture. As a result, most of the Indian parents realized that it's vitally important that the youngsters be educated. And sometimes some of the parents have a almost pathetic trust in education. They believe that education is the sole answer to the Indian problem, but this I do not think so, because education is only a facet. It's not a panacea for the so-called Indian problem.
It's got to be implemented, doesn't
right.
it?
And
individually.
Economics are a big part there. But they're certainly going a long ways in education, as witnessed the number of Indian graduates from Fort Lewis day before yesterday. And the young lady that you saw at the beginning of this program in that beautiful Acoma dress, she was one of the graduates across there and tends to do quite a bit with this education. I was going to ask you, Abe, with the change from Philio Nash as Commissioner of Indian Affairs to Mr. Bennett, do you anticipate many changes as far as policy is concerned?
Well, no doubt there will be changes in the national policy. However, before I make any remarks, I'd like to make this one observation. The objective of the Bureau of Indian Affairs has remained constantly since the Bureau was first organized. The ways and means of implementing this policy have changed from one administration to another.
Mm-hmm.
But the objective of the nation, and of course the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is the organization that carries out the policy of Congress and the nation. The
the changes, if any, that Mr. Bennett will implement, I'm sure will be more or greater partnership with the American Indians. Now, there are some Indians that fear that this partnership will not change the situation as they have felt it before, but as one WAG told me, sure, I believe in partnerships, but the Bureau is going to be the senior partner and we'll have the veto power.
None of this equality business.
We'll be the junior partner.
Be the junior partner. Well, it doesn't necessarily need to be that way, and I don't think it should, because if the American Indian is to become completely integrated into the life of America, he has to stand on his own feet, and he only learns by doing it. That's the only way anyone else ever learns it either. And so if they want to keep too much of a paternal attitude toward him, rather than a helping hand, they can hold it back rather than help it get along. But that's getting out into a field that I'm afraid I'm not too well versed with. However, I tell you, I think to me, seeing it from the outside, the biggest impact has been education. I get around to these reservations and I meet people. Just last fall, I met the first nurse graduate from the Monument Valley Hospital down here. They'd sent her to California, and she's back there nursing now. We find educators, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, clerks, stenographers, waitresses, practically every walk of life that we're accustomed to,
sure,
being filled by the Indian people. And they're doing it, they're learning, and they're doing it just the same as everyone else has to do it. Learn to do it by doing. And, you know, to see that progress, it's always heartwarming to me, because I have many friends down there, and I like to go and visit with them, and some of them are enthusiastic, some, as you say, are a little fearful or skeptical, but generally, I think a great deal of progress has been made. I know there has been in the last 35 years, particularly.
But I hope that they don't lose their language and their culture. I feel this way about it, that they're a minority on the American scene, but they have a great, great deal to contribute to the general culture around them. Specifically, I think that this is going to be true in years to come, that as cities get so big and as space becomes so much crowded, and therefore the wilderness bill and all of these things, I think that just from the standpoint of mental health of the American people, mental hygiene, that this minority group of the American Indian, with his attunement with nature, with his serenity, and some things like that, I believe that they have a lot to teach the general culture and enrich it a great, great deal. I would hate to see them lose their language and their customs
and things like this.
Economically, they have to progress, but I hope culturally, they keep their old culture pretty well.
Yeah.
Well, of course, I think this is wishful thinking when one considers that the Indian population today is approximately 550,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is roughly 0.1% of the total population, so they're totally engulfed by the American society. Now, how can they survive under such an environment? Now, I have my personal philosophy regarding cultural survival. I think the only way a culture can survive is for the minority culture to make a contribution to the greater culture.
That's right.
And this way, the older values or the indigenous values can be become
for sure
viable.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, I do not believe that the Indians can afford to isolate themselves culturally, economically, because if they do, they will die on the vine and as a result commit cultural suicide.
That
this is a very good point, Abe. There's a lot of truth in it. But as they, what do you see, for instance, for this area right here with Navajo Dam and the water that's going to go down and the farms that are going to be developed there and other dams in the southwest? Is this going to have a big impact, or is it going to take care of only a very small number of the people?
Yes, I think the impact is going to be tremendous in the entire southwest. As all of us realize, water is a very valuable asset.
Yeah.
And with the Navajo Irrigation Project, with 100,000 acres being under irrigation, will certainly improve a lot of the Navajo Indians.
Oh, yeah.
To say nothing of the side effects that this economy will have for the non-Indian communities as well.
That's right. Well, look what it did for you people at Ignacio when they put in Pine River Dam and gave them an abundance of water so that they share in that water out of that reservoir, and look the way they're developing their farms.
Farms, right? I mean, with livestock, with a great deal of livestock, and have a great deal of potential in that.
They certainly do.
In that area. Mm-hmm. Certainly have. Arthur, what are those artifacts you have there?
Well, Bob, I have here some real old Navajo jewelry. This is silver work that was done way on back. As you know, the Navajo people learned their silver work from the Spanish.
From the Spanish,
when
yes.
They came in, and this is early crude work. These pieces come from the old Ralph Townsend collection, and Ralph passed away along about 1930. I got his collection together with all his pawn that he had down at his trading post. Those two pieces are of the real old.
Boy, they are. They
they're the crude.
Yes.
They really
bad. Yes. When did you get these, Arthur?
I got them in 1930.
Well, my goodness. They are interesting from the standpoint of being the first work that some Indians did in a particular craft.
Yeah, that's right.
This has been another facet, revitalization of some of their crafts. As for instance, these two pots right here, Mrs. Lewis, probably one of the most famous potters in the Southwest. Now that's Cecilia's mother, the girl that was on the camera when we first started this program, from Acoma, and the basketware, the silversmithing, and all of this.
Now here's a transition piece. These two here, this one came first, and then that one. And this type of work went out about 30 years ago pretty well. They improved on their work considerably. The stones in this, I don't know what they are. They're not turquoise because they're... those are the old green turquoise.
Green turquoise. Mm-hmm.
And then this transition piece here is another piece with the green turquoise in it. And from that, they came to the modern jewelry that we see here all the time.
Very excellent
work.
Very excellent.
And they have improved
silversmithing
remarkably, the same as they have in the weaving, although they're not weaving as much now as they used to because we have too many blankets available to buy and those kind of things. And I don't think they get possibly paid enough for the work they do.
That's probably right. Abe, what are they doing in other areas of crafts that you know about?
Well, there is a great movement to revitalize some of the arts and crafts. Some of them were almost forgotten by some of the tribal groups. And some of the tribal groups have started a great effort to revive the lost arts. And as a result, they're on a comeback. One of the outstanding schools in the Southwest probably is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where the Bureau of Indian Affairs have tribes or children from all the tribes in the country enrolled, and there's an attempt being made to create modern American Indian art.
Is that the one run by George Boyce?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've been there. I know where it is.
Well, you know, you were telling me about it. You were an immigrant, and I thought it's interesting. I think you ought to tell Bob about it. You know, when I was visiting with you the other day.
Well, you know, this is a country of immigrants, and the Indians like to kid the white people as being recent immigrants coming off the Mayflower or coming off the boat.
Yes.
But actually, the Indians themselves are immigrant to this country, as the anthropologists tell us.
Certainly, yes.
We came to this country through the Bering Strait. Yeah. However, getting back to my my name, actually, this has always been a source of embarrassment to me because I'm from Isleta Pueblo and my name is Zuni. I did some research on this and I gave it up after a while. This is just like trying to trace your family tree and finding some skeleton and then backtracking. I discovered that during the last 100 years and even earlier, that the Pueblo Indians used to migrate from one pueblo to another whenever they experienced famine. So as a result, throughout the history of the Indians in the Southwest, especially the Pueblos, there is a history that indicates that they migrated from one pueblo to another. And of course, as time went on, some of them were adopted by the tribal groups and became members of that particular tribe. It so happened that some of the people from Zuni Pueblo migrated to Isleta and stayed down there and became a part of, or became members of the tribe, and hence the name Zuni. However, I am not claiming membership in the Zuni Pueblo at all.
You're in Isleta then?
Yes.
Well, I thought that was interesting because I don't think it's common knowledge among the people that situations like that did occur.
No. It isn't general knowledge. Anthropologists have found out, I think, in recent years that there was a great deal more movement back and forth, not only among the Pueblos, but actually trading.
Assignment 6 has brought you San Juan Heritage, produced by this station in cooperation with the Center for Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College. Your hosts for this series, Dr. Robert Delaney and Mr. Arthur Wyatt. Their guest on tonight's program was Mr. Abe Zuni, superintendent of the Consolidated Ute Agency. Be watching in 1 month, on May 31st, for the next in this series. San Juan Heritage is directed by Mike Nikas, Director of Information at Fort Lewis College. Engineering by Frank Graham and Leonard Wilson. Camera by David Glenn. This is Bill Sullivan speaking, and thanking you for joining us on San Juan Heritage.